Hello and welcome to OU's Nach Yomi. You can find this year posted at ouradio.org/nach or on my website, ericlevy.com, under the recording section. Hi, this is Rabbi Eric Levy, and I am pleased to bring to you Sefer Yeshayahu, chapter 46, Perek Mem Vav, on this Yom HaZikaron, Israel Memorial Day, Tafshin Samachet, 5768. Chapter 46 is a continuation of the previous chapter. It really flows right in. And its contrast of the uniqueness and omnipotence and the eternality of God, as opposed to the artificialness of the idols and nations, is a theme which we started before in chapter 45, and we're continuing here. Remember that chapter 46 actually broke down into two parts. The first part was the Koresh prophecy. And then the second part was the friction, and that included, that first part included the friction between the prophet and those in Israel who did not want to accept Koresh as the anointed one. They simply could not believe that they were going to be saved and did not think that they were going to be saved from Babylon, from their exile, by a non-Jewish king, Koresh, Cyrus the Great. Starting from verse 14 in the previous chapter, the focus is on monotheism versus idol worship, as I just mentioned and as we'll continue talking about in this chapter. I had mentioned yesterday that it wasn't clear if the prophecy of the second part of the idol worship was directly connected to the Koresh prophecy in the first part of the chapter. I think that it is, based on verse 18 of the previous chapter, whose message is, hey, I didn't create the world to be barren, but for the people to dwell on it. The implication is that the Jews would be sent home from exile, and they would be sent home soon. On the other hand, since the focus was on Egypt, Cush, and Sheba, those countries, and their idols and their captivity, it was possible or was more difficult to say that there was absolutely a connection between the Koresh and redemption prophecy of the first part of the chapter. As an aside, one of the problems of all of these prophecies of the Babylonian captivity, that is, starting from Perek Mem, chapter 40, pretty much to the end of the book of Yeshayahu, is that we have very little historical information written about them in the Torah, in Tanakh. The narratives about Ashur from 150 years later, the first 39 chapters of the book, are very rich, and therefore we can take those prophecies in those first chapters of Yeshayahu and get a sense of what the prophecies are referring to, because you can look and say from Malachim, the book of Kings, or the book of Chronicles, and just get a sense of what's going on. But the Jews' existence in Babel, those 70 years, is a dark age. There was really nothing being written from a narrative standpoint. There was prophecy, but there was no narrative. And so we can really only make attempts to make educated guesses about what's driving the prophecy. We can guess in the previous chapter that the people are upset about Koresh being the anointed one based on the fact that God is stressing, hey, he's really the one and I have the ability to make creations do and what I need them to do, and it doesn't make a difference to what kind of creations they are. We can guess about the slavery of Egypt and Cush and Sheba as they pass by Jerusalem in chains and they schlep along their useless idols. But in the end, it's still a bit of a guess because we simply have no narrative of which to compare these prophecies. A friend of mine, a great rav by name Jeremy Lukens, Rabbi Jeremy Lukens, said that these prophecies are much like the op-ed pages of the New York Times. You could read them, but they really do assume that you've read the first page of the New York Times. That is, the assumption is you know what the news is, and based on the news, we can now make a commentary. Here we have a lot of commentary with very, very little news. Now, getting back to chapter 46, finally, the focus is without question on Babylon. That is, while we're talking about idols, we are talking about Babylonian idols. And therefore, we are talking about the Jews who are in Babel, and we are talking about their captivity in Babel after the destruction of the first temple, I believe. We know this because the verse names the two main gods, or two of the main gods of Babylon, Bel and Nebo. Kara Bel Kores Nebo, Hayu Atzabehem Lachaya Vila Behema, Nesuotechem Amusot Masa La'ayefa. Bel has bent, Nebo has crouched, Their graven images have been given to wild and to domesticated animals. From the context, the implication that the animals are bearing the weight of these graven images of these idols, since the idols can't walk for themselves and they're fallen and bent over. Now, from here on, the prophet seems to be speaking directly to the idols, so to speak, and mocking them. I mean, obviously they're not real, but that's part of the mockery. Let me continue with the translation. The ones who bear you are weighed down, i.e. those animals. You are a load for the weary. Now, in the simplest sense, this is like the passages that we've seen before. The idols are just inert lumps, and they are a burden to the people foolish enough to believe in them, and literally a burden for their beasts and for themselves as they are carried off into slavery or as they are relocated in defeat. There is also a possibility in the word kara and kores of some pretty nasty insults. Rashi understands the second term, kores, as squatting to relieve oneself, similar to the insult that Eliyahu flings at the worshippers of Baal in the Book of Kings during their showdown on Mount Carmel near Haifa. Ibn Ezra, in his very elusive and circumspect way, says that the terms kara and kores have a sense that these two things are being forced into intimacy, shall we say. Indeed, the word kara is used in just this way. It has a sexual overtone in Devorah's song, Kara Nafal Shachav, over when she's talking about Sisra and Yael, in chapter 5 of Judges. That's where that song is. I suspect that the Ibn Ezra is right, since the kara, I think, here is used mockingly. That is, in the way that the idols are bent to each other, in contrast with what we had in the end of the previous chapter, which was Yichra Kol Berach, Yishtachaveh Kol Ashon, that every knee will be bent. That is, to a true God, there is true supplication, a true bending of the knee, and to a false a deviant God, there is a false and deviant supplication. But there's also another double meaning of the word masa, which is very critical to understanding this pasuk, but we'll soon see it by reading in the upcoming verses. Let me continue. I will continue on. Karsu, karu, yachdav, lo yochlu maleit masa v'nafsham bashevi halacha. They bend and crouch together, yachdav. Ibn Ezra definitely seems to have the right of it here. What's interesting are Ibn Ezra's very circumspect words. He writes, V'hatam yadua ve'in ra'ui likotivo. The meaning is known and it is inappropriate to write it down. But getting back to the verse, they cannot escape their burden. Notice that word masa again that I hinted at last pasuk. They themselves have gone into captivity. That is, the idols themselves have gone into captivity. Now, in contrast, God says to Israel, Shimu Eli Beit Yaakov, V'chol She'erit Beit Yisrael, Ha'amusim Mini Veten, Ha'nesu'im Mini Racham. Listen to me, O house of Jacob, you remnants of the house of Israel, who are carried from birth, ha'amusim mine beten, and supported from the time of exiting the womb, ha'nisu'im mine racham. Note that we have the word amusim again, but here it's a carrying in the positive sense. That is, God helps you. He carries you, Israel, in contrast to the gods Bel and Nebo of Babylon, who they themselves had to be carried by the beasts. That is, rather than God doing the amus, it's the people who have to amus their gods to carry their gods. Essentially, these gods are weighting down their beasts and their believers, both metaphorically and literally, as opposed to God who actually lifts up the Jewish people. And moreover, there's also this double play on nisuim, which means to bear or support. And this is what I've been hinting at in the last few psukim. It is also used, the word nisa or yisa means when God forgives a sin. Literally, he lifts the burden of the sin off. And it's used like that all over the Torah. So here, religiously, while the Babylonian gods add to the people's sin, they become a masa for the people, for their animals. The one true God removes the sin from the very womb. Hanesu'im mini racham. But notice that the word racham also has a double meaning. There's all kinds of beautiful play on words and double meanings here. The word racham means not only womb, but it means God forgives the sins out of mercy. And in Aramaic, which the people certainly spoke at this time, the word racham actually means love. And this is like a mother's love and like a mother's mercy that she has on the products of her womb, on her rechem. Va'ad zikna ani hu, va'ad seva ani esbol. Ani asiti va'ani esa, ani esbol va'amalet. And until old age I am he, until old age. I'm sorry, I'm not distinguishing between zikna, old age, and seva. Perhaps seva means something like until everything is gray. I will carry it. That is, I'll take care of you until the very end. I made it, asiti, I will bear it, esa. See the beautiful play on asiti and esa. I will carry it, and I will allow escape. And note again the contrast with the idols, who cannot provide escape, lo yachlu limaleit, or they cannot escape themselves, but God provides the escape or the freedom for his own people. And here I think that we're essentially continuing in the theology lesson, and it's a speech against anthropomorphism in the next pasuk. That is, up to now we've been talking about God's power versus the other idols who become a burden, and God actually lifts the burdens. And now we're talking about how you can anthropomorphize God or create an image out of God to capture his essence. Lemi tidam yuni vitashvu vitam shiluni vinidmeh. Who will you liken me to and create or equal? Who will you liken me to that it should be the same or that it should be similar? Which means there's no way that you can create a graven image to attempt to capture. And the interesting thing is, even in the Torah, it warns against creating a graven image, but not to worship those images, but to somehow capture the essence of God. And that's why that pasuk says, don't try it. Don't do the sun, the moon, the stars, or anything else, because there is no way to capture the image of God. And all you do is lessen it if you attempt to do so. But here, the real problem that we'll see is that people are really kind of, we'll see in Babel, that they really did adopt this idea of creating images to God. Hazalim zahav mikis v'chesef bakane yishkolu yiskeru tzaref yaseyu el yizgedu af yishtachavu. And here he's mocking or comparing himself against the work of these Babylonians or these idol worshippers. They empty the gold from their pockets, which is kind of like a really nice idea because it indicates not only that they're using gold to create their gods, but it costs them humongous amounts of money. And Judaism and monotheism, you don't have to spend money to get in. It's not a cult where the more you pay, the higher you go up in status. Sure, I mean, it's true. You have to spend a lot on lulav and etrog, and people buy very nice chanukiyot and all kinds of things. But ultimately, it don't cost any money. Don't cost no money to become a worshiper of God. And measure silver across the scale balance. V'chesef bakanei yishkolu. They hire metal workers and to make a god. They bow down to it, even prostrate themselves to it. Yisa'uhu al katev yizbeluhu v'yanichu tachta v'ya'amod mimkomo lo yamish af yitzakela v'lo ya'anem yitzarato lo yoshenu. They bear it and carry it on their shoulders. I.e., it's the opposite of how it's supposed to work. God should bear the burden of the people, not the other way around. They put it in its place, and there it stands, v'yamod, never leaving its place, lo yamush. That's the idea of omnipresence versus the idea of a local god. That is, their gods are put into a single place, because that's where the gods had power in a limited city or region, as opposed to God who is omnipresent. They yell to it, and it does not answer, and from their strife, mitzarato, lo yoshienu, it will not sing. And with the next verse, it seems clear that the children of Israel who are in exile and have adopted or syncretized some of the practices of their captors, unfortunately, and that always happens when you're immersed, especially captive and enslaved into a people, you tend to not so much throw away your religion, but adopt or syncretize other people's religions into yours. And they're trying to be taught by God, now that the exile is almost at an end, they're trying to be taught how to get rid of that contamination. Zichru zot, v'hit oshashu, hashivu poshim alev. Remember this and be strong. Return on your minds, or literally your hearts, you sinners. That is, sort of do tshuva, hashivu, come back. A poshea, by the way, a poshim is a specific type of sinner, one who throws off the yoke of his true master. And what are they supposed to remember? The pasuk says zichru zot, but it doesn't say what. So we find out in the next pasuk, zichru rishonot me'olam. Remember the way it was at the very beginning. That is, before you were exiled, and when you were a unique nation in your own land. Ki anochi el ve'ein od, Elohim ve'efes kamoni. Remember that I am God, and that there is no other God, i.e. monotheism, and another other is like me, i.e. a complete uniqueness, and nothing can be parallel to God. It's like a theology lesson, which is attempting to be used to burn away the syncretism, the adoption of the Babylonian exile Jews of these false aspects of their worship. Magid mereshita charid mikedem ashelona asu omer atzati takum v'chol chafzi eze. I tell or foretell, Magid, or perhaps I say what will be from the beginning, mereshit, until the end, acharit, i.e. the timelessness of God is being taught to the people. Going back to the pasuk, and tell from the beginning that which was not occurred. This is omniscience, knowing what is going to happen in the future. And I'd like to go out like on a little bit of a shaky limb here, and say that perhaps the way to translate mikedem asher lo nasu means, and I tell mikedem asher lo nasu before anything was even created. There is perhaps an idea of ex nihilo, that is God being alone before creation, there being nothing else but God. A lot of people would say that's really a medieval concept and not so really found in the biblical. And perhaps it's true that this simply means that God said from the beginning that which would be made, omniscience. But there may just be a sense that even before things were created, God already had a plan. Continue on with the pasuk. Who says my plans will be fulfilled? That is, I will make happen exactly. I say my plans will be fulfilled, and whatever I desire, I will do. And that's the idea of omnipotence. Again, it's like this theology lesson in just a few verses. Korei mimizrach ayit. Me'eretz merchak ish atzati, af dibarti, af aviena, yatzarti, af esenat. Really nice poetry. And here is, we have essentially a critical verse. The verse about the eagle. What are my plans that I've foretold? Because God mentioned in the previous pasuk that essentially he foretells plans from the very beginning of time. Now you could say that's just an abstract theology lesson, but I think what it actually is he's talking not only abstractly about the idea of an omniscient and omnipotent God, but he's talking specifically about the plan which he's foretelling to the people in Bavel. I call Korei mimizrach ayit, an eagle from the east, me'eretz merchak, from a faraway land. Ish atzati, the man of my plan. Actually sounds almost as good in English as it does in Hebrew. Ish atzati. I have spoken, I will bring it, i.e. my plan, I fashioned it, and I will do it. So here, I believe we return to the beginning. That is the beginning of the previous chapter. We come full circle. That is, who is the man of the plan? Who is this ayat, the eagle from the east? And remember that Persia is to the east of Babylon. This is none other than Koresh, the man of my plan. But besides this arguable metaphor, that is, I'm going out a little bit on a limb here, I'm saying that ayat is a metaphor for Koresh, and he's talking to his people and specifically saying, I'll tell you what my plan is to bring Koresh. I think there's another argument that could be brought to bear, that this pasuk, and therefore the entire chapter really, has to do specifically, is aimed specifically at the people of Bavel who are having a hard time with God's message. Let's go back to the citation of those very two gods, Bel and Nebo. They actually, probably if you wanted to pick the pantheistic god, it could be Marduk. And Bel is sometimes a synonym for Marduk. It could be Ishtar. But I think none of this is an accident. Why? Because if you remember, Korah sent a letter to the Jews saying, the Lord God is sending you home. But when he wrote the letter to the Babylonians, when he freed them to worship their own gods and to rebuild their own temples, he wrote a very similar letter, except it reads like this. I am Cyrus, king of the world. This we have actually on a cylinder, which was recovered. This is his actual writing. Great king, legitimate king, king of Babylon. He's just taken over Babylon. King of Sumer and Akkad, king of the four corners, whose rule Bel and Nebo love. Whom they, i.e. Bel and Nebo, want as a king to please their hearts. That is, I, who am a Persian king, am accepted by your Babylonian king gods, and therefore you should accept me as well. And he goes on, when I entered Babylon as a friend, and when I established the seat of government in the palace of the ruler, under jubilation and rejoicing, etc., etc., etc. It's quite the PR. It's quite the PR letter. So perhaps our Perek is a reaction to that letter. Of Bel and Nebo love Cyrus, who is bringing peace to Bavel. That is, in order to accept Koresh as a Mashiach, as an anointed one who is doing God's will, they have to accept that. But on the other hand, they're recognizing, the Navi is recognizing that Koresh is a pantheist or is willing to say anything he wants to anybody. And he's making fun of that letter that he wrote to the Babylonians and yet saying that Koresh is still the guy. On the other hand, first of all, it's not clear that they knew about the letter at the time. And also, you might ask a question and say, well, if they're having problems and doubts about Koresh being a worthy leader, focusing on the fact that he is calling on Bel and Nebo, sort of go against the point. It's true, or it could be the other way. I'm telling you to give up your syncretism, your bad worship, and go after Koresh. But now maybe the prophet, perhaps, and I'm like way out on a limb here, I'm speculating, but perhaps he's saying, listen, you can start believing Koresh. But then I have another fear, that you'll turn Koresh into a deity, that he'll become the king of the Jews, and he's not the king of the Jews. He's just a king who is enabling the Jews. So maybe he's trying to say, all right, let's go with Koresh, but don't go too far. And maybe because of all these problems, and as I mentioned before, we really don't have a historical background, so it's hard to pinpoint these prophecies. Rashi and others do not connect this the eagle with Koresh at all, especially because they really don't want to give him the cred, the street cred, of being as mighty as an eye. Still, I think that's exactly what we're talking about here. And these two chapters really have to do with one another. One is that Koresh is coming, you have to believe in my prophecy. And two, in order to really take advantage of my prophecy, you got to get rid of the syncretism, rid of the false idol worship, and don't restart it, especially with another person. Shimu elai abirei lev harachokim mitzdaka. Listen to me, you strong, in a negative strength. Sense of strength, abir, of mind, literally heart, who are far from the truth, harachokim mitzdaka. Again, it's hard to say exactly who we're talking to and what it is they're being hard-hearted about. It could be those who will not say that Koresh is not going to be the one to bring them back to Zion, and in fact that they're not going to be going back to Zion anytime soon. They do not see the light at the end of the tunnel, regardless of what this Yeshayahu is saying, what this prophet is saying. It could be these are just Musar to people of Israel who have accepted other kinds of worship and theology and syncretize into their own. However, I do think it's referring specifically to those who refuse to believe that the redemption is coming and that Koresh will bring it. And why do I believe that? Because the words here are turned around. Instead of here where it says, Harachokim mitzdaka, you are far from righteousness or far from the truth, the next pasuk says, Keiravti tzidkati lo tirchak. Uchwati lo ta'acher, v'natati v'tzion teshua li'Yisrael tifarti. I am bringing my truth close, my righteousness. It's not far. My salvation will not be delayed. I will place salvation in Zion and place my glory into the people of Israel.